Hey, this is post-production Matthew Marissa. This is a part two, so if you haven't seen or listened to the previous part, check that out first. In this one, we are a bit more critical, but I want to note that since we recorded this, the game has received a few updates, primarily to the UX, UI, /Civipedia, which are all things that we're pretty negative on, so some of the information in this may be a little outdated. Just keep that in mind.
I'm connecting to the internet.
Internet.
Networking software.
World Wide Web.
The web.
Computer today.
Computer.
NetSurfer Pro.
The change that I don't like is, as a single-player game at least, you are basically just playing a England simulator. So we mentioned Distant Lands.
Yeah.
This is an integral aspect that I do understand and I like the idea of. The idea is basically, in the first age, you are not going to get the ability to cross deep ocean. One of my favorite things to do in previous Civ games is hard rush cartography so that I can go across the ocean. You just can't do that until the exploration age in Civ 7. But the thing that they did, essentially, is that once the exploration age comes along, your Civ has access to distant lands where there are a couple of other Civs and a bunch more independent peoples, which is a good change that I do like. We'll talk about that later. This is a gameplay consideration that is kind of added because it was easy to, like, get stuck. I mean, it is still a little easy to get stuck if you're, like, on a corner, you know, a bad corner of the continent you start on. And so the idea of sectioning it off to a specific age that is about going to the new land and, you know, settling new cities, talking to the people there, colonizing the people there, like, that makes sense. That is something that I like the idea of, but the end result is kind of that, like, I can't even necessarily say that it's samey, but it's sort of like, There's a very specific style of game you are playing, and by default, that is the style of game you are kind of always playing.
Yeah, so the main purpose of this is, like, it's not even great for pure expansion, because usually the distant lands, which in single-player games will have fewer players, or fewer, like, civs, than the mainland.
Yeah.
Usually two if it's a small map, whereas the mainland has four. The distant lands will mostly be covered by existing civs, which yeah. have had all this room to build out. So, like, you might be able to get a few settlements on or near the coast, but otherwise you'll have to go to war with them, whether or not that is a outright intentional thing of, like, doesn't it suck that, or like, isn't it bad to colonize because you have to put yourself at a disadvantage? It kind of discourages going to war in distant lands.
Yeah.
Because it's harder to get units there, and then also you'll be sad and, you know, all these other things that make it harder to do that. But the tiny islands in between the continents are usually, like, 3 to 5 spaces big, not enough to have a city at all.
Yeah.
And the reason for that is because they're mainly for the treasure fleets, which I do have a bit of a rant, but that can wait. And the idea is that you are creating these settlements almost purely, well, A, to have an outpost in the water that says when other people are coming to your continent to kill you, but mainly to get one specific resource that you can then ship to your civilization's main continent.
Yeah.
That is a very colonial way of thinking that is explicitly the only way to get economic legacy points.
Yeah.
I think it is kind of awkward, not necessarily because it implies colonialism good or promotes that. I think representation versus promotion is a complicated issue that we don't need to talk about because we can't. It's too complicated to...
Yeah.
I think it's just kind of boring almost that every single time it's like, oh, time to colonize, time to get this tiny settlement on one resource. And then, like, there's not really any alternative to, well, they added, I think, a civic that one civilization has access to, because some civics are locked for certain civs, to, like, you can spawn treasure fleets on mainland that are connected to navigable rivers, which are rivers that boats can go through.
Yeah.
That is really the only alternative to getting economic points in doing the economic victory. And, like, again, I'm not trying to make a morality judgment on the game for depicting this. It's more so that it becomes very rote.
Yeah,
and I think that is more of an issue I have, is that in previous Civ games, I think they did a good job at creating leaders that encouraged a wider variety of strategies. And by consolidating the like ages into these unique games, these like mini games, you end up focusing on the mini games, but the Civs and leaders don't often do much to make that unique.
Yeah.
I feel like what you mentioned about ocean travel being locked to exploration and further is kind of bitter, because it means that you can't have a nautical civilization in antiquity without fundamentally changing the game.
Yeah.
You can have boats, but the boats only work on your mainland and have a lot of limitations. Because, like, other people are going to have continental cities, but, like, you're not going to get much use out of boats unless it's to attack one continental city.
Yeah,
and if,
yeah.
And if you're just trying to use the boat to scout outward, then you're better using scouts because they can see further. And also, you need to be allies or have open border. And, like, essentially, like, it feels like there is very little aquatic nautical gameplay. And they do that on purpose. But like you said, it means you can't have things like, was it Coupe who could start on the sea?
Yeah, yeah. Maui? Coupe was always one of my favorite ones to play in Civ.
You can't have Maui in Civ 7 because the sea, like, doesn't exist in the Antiquity Age.
Yeah. I brought up Kamehameha because he was one of my favorites in Civ 5, because he got, like, the idea with him was that you could immediately start going across the ocean.
And I guess you could do that if you started an exploration. It just means that you're skipping out on a third of an entire game.
Yeah. It's the kind of thing where, like, I don't want to criticize it from a Watsonian perspective. I do kind of get what they're going for. Like, I get the idea of what they're trying to present, especially if you consider this to be something like a game that puts you in the perspective of a colonial power, which primarily that's what a lot of these games are.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I do understand that idea of there's this beautiful, quote-unquote, untouched new land that happens to have a bunch of inconveniences on it, like other civs and independent people. Like, that's the mindset that they're trying to put you in, and I understand that.
What ends up happening oftentimes with Civ is that the ideal win state is that of being a horrible, like, warlord emperor. But the counterplay is the, like, more, I don't want to say moral, but it's sort of the more humanist choice.
Yeah.
So, for example, in the modern era culture victory, you need to get artifacts. You get artifacts from building explorers and excavating dig sites. They've changed how this works in the most recent patch as of recording, which is March 6th, 2025. The way it works now is that each dig site, once an excavation has been started by a player, other players' explorers cannot start digging on that excavation site. I think there are more dig sites, and you can also now do excavations on natural wonders, which every player can do that once per wonder. But in general, artifacts which you get from these are first come, first serve. This means that the ideal win state is to have explorers all around the world stealing ancient relics from people and putting them in your own museum, aka England. But the counterplay then is to, you know, develop your own culture and dig up your own sites to prioritize the preservation of your own history, which is a kind of an interesting bit that the counterplay has created that. Just like I said, the ideal state is to colonize like one or two settlements on the distant lands and then fight over land there. The counterplay is just to win those fights and, you know, play defensively, which drives out the invaders, and you'll probably even get an extra settlement from that by stealing it from them.
Yeah.
So the counterplay is the, like, quote-unquote moral choice in this instance, or like I said, the more humanist choice, whereas the ideal state is to be a monster. And I don't know if that's cool or not, but I think that is an interesting element. The problem is that with treasure fleets, the counterplay is just to settle the treasure fleets before other people do.
Or steal them from other players.
Oh, right, you can.
You can pillage them, but like that...
You can be a pirate.
You can be a pirate, which, okay, that's fun.
I want to be a pirate.
I like that idea. I actually will admit, I think that all of the economic victories are my favorite. I think that the fact that economic victory now has their own minor amount of micro that becomes less micro as the game goes on, like, is very fun.
You know what else becomes less micro as the game goes on? My civilization. Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. Okay. I want to say the thing I like that was changed, diplomacy.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So here's the problem is when you're programming AI in a diplomatic game, which has actual player to player politicking, you have to program a value system that the AI follows that encourages their behavior and makes them seem human enough that they can be rationed with or reasoned with, but also irrational enough that they can mimic human behavior. This is bad. This is hard. This sucks. What they have done is they have created pure, like, resource economics around diplomacy. They had diplomatic points or, like, votes in Civ 6. I think it was, like, influence.
I know that there was influence, and I know in Civ 5, the World Congress that was held, like, every round... that was held like every, yeah, you know, 20 rounds or whatever, gave you votes based on who you were suzerain of and, yeah, like, you know, some wonders, so, and civs and whatnot.
The World Congress sucks. I don't like it. And they don't have it in Civ 7. Influence is spent to become suzerain of an independent power, which turns it into a city state once it's become suzerain. It takes place over a number of turns, and all the costs for everything influence related increase at per age. You can use influence to expand trade routes to allow for more trade routes to one civ. You can use influence to start projects or endeavors, which are beneficial to both parties. The other party can spend influence to make it better for both of them. Otherwise, it'll give the person who started it more bonuses and, yeah, give the person who didn't start it a smaller one. Like, for example, early on, the cultural exchange endeavor will give the founder of it 4 culture points and the receiver 2 culture points per turn.
But if the other person supports it,
then it's 6 for both players.
Yeah.
You can also reject it, which means they can't do endeavors for a number of turns and your relationship decreases.
Yeah.
You can do sanctions, which decrease your relationship. Endeavors increase them. You can then do espionage if you're not friends, and you can start wars, and starting wars will give the other player more influence if you have a better relationship with them, because influence is then used to create war weariness, which reduces the happiness. It's like a tug of war.
Yeah.
It reduces the happiness of the opponent if you have more war support than they do.
It's kind of a replacement for the, like, warmonger penalty of previous games, where, like, now it's like it gives other players more influence to initiate wars,
yeah,
that then is something they can actively choose to put towards the effort of,
yeah,
people don't like this, which gives the aggressor, the person with the less war support, negatives to, like, happiness and what have,
yeah,
you, based on how much influence, yeah, there is.
In this case, what happens is that it creates a system where you can more mathematically perceive how an AI's behavior in relation with you will change. You will be like, oh, they're not happy with me, but if I'm able to start some, you know, endeavors or reconcile with them, it'll cost me this many points but give me this much of a relationship boost. It is less realistic, less human behavior, but I think it works better for playing against AI who are stupid anyways.
Like, it makes a lot of sense from a kind of, you know, a realpolitik point of view of, like, you are earning an amount of soft power, an amount of social capital that you then have to cash in by being, yeah, like, let's do a science pact. Let's do a merchant pact. The one note that I have for the diplomacy is it is a fucking slam dunk. I love it. I also love how independent peoples also require it to become suzerain of them. That gives a lot of fun push and pull of, like, do I focus on making good relationships with the civs? Do I focus on getting enough that I can become suzerain? That's a, yeah, very fun system.
And being suzerain gives you bonuses that often scale with how many suzerainties you have.
Yes, yes. However, the one thing that I kind of hate, I don't know how the fuck to start science or culture pacts with others. I think it might
I
think it might be based on what civ you pick, because
I think it's leader. Because so every leader has 2 endeavors they can do, and it's usually based on whether they are the 6 types.
Yeah.
So military has support troops, economic has trade exchange, or trade, something like that. Cultural has cross-cultural exchange, scientific has research pact, and expansion has...
I think expansion has either the happiness one or the, like, I think there is a food one as well.
There is a food one. I think the happiness is for diplomatic leaders.
Yeah, yeah. Happiness
because happiness is a diplomatic resource as well.
And a warm gun.
Yeah, and then, like, nice. And then Ibn Battuta has his own unique one.
Yes,
so
yes.
Does, what is it? There's another leader. I think one of the Lafayettes has one that adds a social policy slot.
I know that Napoleon has a unique sanction, which makes everybody hate him.
Yeah.
Napoleon is very fun. Side note, Napoleon's extremely fun because he gets gold per turn based on how many people hate him,
mm-hmm.
which is so funny to me.
Yeah. He's a shock jock.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's just you're not playing the right leader.
Yeah, okay.
I'm sorry.
I guess that does, I guess, make sense. Maybe that leads directly into... So I had a structure for my notes, but, like, we've been talking enough that I don't think it matters.
One more thing.
Oh, and one more thing.
I like the way
thing.
Happiness works.
Yes.
So, happiness has been simplified a lot. It used to be this complicated system of nerfs to different things based on how happy your city was. The way it works is happiness... Okay, you want your cities to be happy. If they are zero or less happy, they are unhappy. And if they get too unhappy, they'll start rioting, which destroys districts in your civ, destroys tiles, and then eventually that city can riot and completely flip into independent.
Yeah. I've actually had games where I got a civ's city because I guess it was unhappy because of, like, the crisis.
Yeah.
Which is kind of cool, I will say.
So there is still kind of loyalty, but more just because of happiness. Otherwise, happiness will contribute to a happiness, like,
pool.
And once it reaches a certain amount, you'll have a celebration.
Yeah.
Celebrations give you momentary buffs to one of two things based on which government you choose at the start of the era. And also, it gives you a new social policy slot. A lot of early map choices from, like, the camps and traders and stuff will let you choose either, like, happiness or a different resource because happiness can unlock those policy slots and give you those buffs.
It is a very Yeah, it's a very fun system that kind of acts like a squishing of, like, celebrations. We love the King Day, Golden Ages, like...
Oh, yeah, I hated Civ 6 Golden Ages because they're, like, achievements you have to get, and if you get them, you're so far ahead of everyone else.
Yeah.
But, like, some of the achievements are just so stupid.
yeah, it was... Oh,
I hated those. They're gone, thank God.
So...
Also, if your city is not on water, it just gets -5 happiness. You have a settlement limit that increases with civics, and if you go over the settlement limit, every city in your civilization gets -5 happiness per city over settlement limit, which means you can actually plan around that and try to make larger civs or have more cities than the settlement limit, knowing you have an amount of happiness over on each city.
Yeah. It's a very fun push and pull system.
Yeah.
So,
okay.
I think it's time to talk about the big problem.
Yes.
So, the one called, if there is one called shot that I want to make about the development of Civ 7, it is this. In 2023, halfway through 2023, Marvel Midnight Suns, which was a sort of like XCOM-like Marvel game that Firaxis developed, failed to meet expectations, and 30 Firaxis developers were laid off. Now, I want to, you know, here's my asterisk. I don't have a crystal ball that looks directly into Firaxis headquarters. I do not have a phone that I can ring Sid Meier up and say, hey, what the fuck? I don't know how Firaxis works, but... I have enough general knowledge about the video game industry and also how people work that I can pretty confidently say, assuming that they announced it in February of 2023, assuming that it was in development for about double that time before it came out, that means that there was about a year and a half where it was announced. So let's say it's a 3-year, 4-year development cycle. Losing 30 people in the middle of that development cycle probably didn't help things.
Probably didn't help.
Probably, in fact, is the main point of contention at which a lot of the problems kind of occurred.
And the fact that 2K was willing to lay off so many people for low sales probably meant the deadline was that much more apparent on their necks.
Yeah. I don't know if it was, I will add the asterisk, I don't know if it was a 2K call or if it was a Firaxis call.
Okay.
So, like, I can blame 2K as a publisher for probably, like, I'm willing to bet that deadlines were really tight, I'm willing to bet that there was an amount of, like, we just have to ship a product, it doesn't matter if it is 100% good.
I will say, this is speculation, and I don't think we know exactly what fields those people were laid off from.
Yeah.
It does still suck for 30 people to get fired,
yeah.
And I think losing 30 people from a team of any size has gotta hurt.
This is the kind of thing where, like, if this was our job, if doing this podcast was our job, I would literally go through the credits of Civ 6 and then the credits of Civ 7 and, like, see what names I can, you know, like, essentially go, you probably weren't there, you probably got laid off. Like, that's what I would want to do, to see if, like, the QA team got really, really laid off, because the UI of Civilization 7 is not just one of the worst UIs in a strategy game. I genuinely believe it might be one of the worst UIs in any video game
ever. Okay, so for one thing, I'm going to move past the bit where you said this wasn't your job and you're not treating it like a job. No wonder I have to do so much work. For two thing, okay, there's a lot of issues. One thing many people have said is that, like, you can have a QA team that finds a lot of shit and doesn't get, like, the time or the respect or the budget fix it. The game has to ship at some point, and clearly they were willing to ship with a lot of problems in place, because there's also a lot of bugs that have happened and that aren't related to things like UI or UX. It could just be that this is the state it shipped in. With that in mind, I think, like, it's hard. I don't want to just say, QA is terrible, UI is bad, and they're trying to fix that, but goes back to our point that, like, it's not a great game right now, not for mechanical reasons, but for information reasons.
Yeah,
I think there's a lot of issues, and I have written down a list of grievances that I would like to announce here.
The itemized list of grievances, and I will certainly have my own as well.
Okay. Number one, the UI is awful. Number two, the UX is awful. What does that mean? There's a lot of information that's not told to you or is unclear, as I will expand upon. And they have, like, an in-game wiki. The Civipedia does not tell you enough.
Doesn't tell you enough.
I mentioned earlier that factories, in order for a factory to become a factory, as in, like, part of your factory network to hold factory things, it has to be connected to the capital via a railroad. But like I said, two cities might not be connected via railroad, even if they're the closest two cities to each other. And there's not really a great way to tell, because hovering over a tile doesn't say what's on the tile. It kind of does, but it kind of doesn't. So that's cool and all, but it means there's a lot of times where my strategy gets momentarily brick-walled because of something that I can't tell what the problem is and don't know how to fix. They have a lot of nested menus that tell you important things. For example, in order to see your happiness until next celebration, you have to go to your, resources tab? Or no, your social policy tab, and then click on the happiness tab, which doesn't come up automatically ever.
Yeah!
The social policies in the disasters, which are a mechanic I don't like, show up automatically when they matter, not happiness.
This was something that I actively complained about to you, and that you then later were like, oh, hey, I found where this is.
I didn't find it. I had to watch a YouTube video.
Yeah.
I think it was Boestheus. It was either Bose or Herson that had a video that was like 10 things from Civ 7 you don't know about because Firaxis doesn't tell you. It might have been Herson, actually. But either way, there's that and there's a whole bunch of other things. I love the way resources work, but sometimes it says a resource can't be moved because it doesn't connect to your capital.
Yeah.
And I don't understand why. It can be complicated. I just wish it told you what requirements things like buildings have or mechanics have a bit more clearly, which to me feels like they didn't have a lot of the ability to test the wording and then fix it. That's like such a down the line thing. It doesn't affect shipping the game or playing the game as far as, like, is it literally playable? You can't do like those blind rulebook play tests if you don't have the time for them, but they're also kind of unnecessary, quote unquote.
Yeah. Lower on the list of priorities in a development scenario. Yeah.
So number three is it barely tells you anything. Number four, overbuilding is arcane. Does it remove the bonuses that it gets? Do the buildings from previous ages go away? Do the buildings from previous ages matter?
So
it doesn't show you the difference between the resources you're getting and the resources the tile has. So, like, you can have a tile with a rural improvement that has, like, a bunch of good shit, And then, you know, the game will be like, you should totally put a market here because it'll be worth 6 gold. But like the tile is giving you 3 production, 4 science, 3 culture.
This is something that goes directly into a criticism that I have that I very much agree with, which is that your cities are not readable at a glance, which becomes a problem when your cities need to be readable.
Yeah.
Like, to give you a good example, for what you said with overbuilding, for example, let's say it's the exploration age, you have built an altar. You built like an altar and an ageless building that doesn't matter, let's say. You build an altar and you're like, I want to upgrade this. When you click, you know, whatever building you pick and then you hover over it, the tile is just going to show you like the raw output of the tile currently, essentially. Like it's going to be like you're making 2 culture and 2 hammers, you know, 2 production from this. It does not tell you that 2 culture is coming from the altar. It does not tell you the 2 production is coming from your sawmill or whatever. It just tells you this is what this is producing right now, and this is what placing this building will do.
So if you want to build a temple over an altar, for example, if you click temple, it will not show you the yields of the tile as is.
Yeah.
You have to mouse over the tile and then like, I mean, maybe it does. It's hard to tell. But if you look at like on the tile directly, it'll only show you the new yields.
Yeah, yeah.
So you have to like do the math and look at it beforehand. It again, if it shows you the yields that you're taking away, it's in like the corner, I think. You can't choose which building you overbuild as well, which matters.
Yeah, yeah. Based on like the oldest one.
I think they know about that and they want to change it. It's in the pipeline. Also, so did you know that you can only build urban buildings next to urban buildings or wonders?
Yeah, that's something that I kind of had to figure out by trial by error.
Yeah.
Because it's
very easy to be in a situation where there are empty spaces in your city that you can't build urban buildings on because they're not next to an urban building, even if they're next to a rural one. But also, you don't want to move the rural population there because it sucks.
Now, here's the other thing, too. When I say, like, UI, UX, what buildings you have built are important. What buildings you have built are important, yep. And what rural buildings you have built are important, especially for towns. Like, for example, you build a town, you plop down a workshop, a clay pit, a workshop, a fishing quay, a farm, a workshop, etc. And then at the end of that, when the town can get a specialization, a lot of the benefits you get are like +1 production on workshops, clay pits, and what have you. Mm-hmm. +1, you know, food on farms, fishing. I want to grab Sid Meier and sit him in front of a like 4-hour game that I have played, point at the screen and go, which of these are fishing? Like, which of these are farms? Which of the? Tell me right now, at a glance, how many of these are workshops? How many of these are clay pits? How many of these are farms? And tell me which one of these I should pick. And if you can't tell me this, then go back to the fucking drawing board. I'm sorry.
I will say, fishing boats are the easiest one because it's literally any improved water tile.
Yeah.
Including rivers.
I tend to like default to them because I tend to play a lot of coastal, and it's like the only one that I can immediately tell, well, I have 6 fishing boats.
And like, I kind of can tell what farms and clay pits look like, and
clay pits are a little bit unique.
I'm not sure. It's harder to tell for woodcutters, but like, there isn't an easy way to see what it's going to give you, or...
I think that there is a green outline on the things that would be impacted by it. Like, I think that there's a green outline on quarters and on rural sections in towns specifically.
I want to specify then that while we are talking about these, if they do exist, they are not apparent.
Yeah.
And I think in a lot of ways, the goal of a UI designer, UX designer, is to make those things more apparent. If we're stupid, but we're like observant, imagine how many people, you know, the average stupid person. There's got to be a lot of people who turn it off because they can't find the happiness thing. And
I
couldn't find it until I was told about it from a YouTuber. So like,
I am going to have a very specific rant about a very specific social policy. But I do want to, before we move on to the next grievance, I want to give a bit of a compliment sandwich here. I love resources. One of my biggest pet peeves in Civ 5 and Civ 6 is that places would have a resource like deer, you know. Deer exclusively just means if you put a camp here, it has an extra production. This tile has an extra production. But it took me a very long time while playing Civ 5 and Civ 6 to understand that I didn't somehow like get deer connected as a resource and it did some kind of secondary thing. Well, Civ 7 has changed that to where when you plop down a tile on a resource, you now get that resource. It makes a lot of immediate sense. It gets you an immediate extra little biscuit that you can slot into towns or cities.
The biscuits are good because they give you plus 10% science.
Yep, yep.
In antiquity. their actual effects change through the ages. Usually they're similar, but not always. Biscuits are not as good in exploration.
It's a good system.
Yeah.
It's a really good system.
Teacher, I have a question.
Oh, yes.
How do you add more slots for resources to a city?
Well, Timmy, good question. You need either camels or a specific wonder or a specific leader, and that's pretty much it.
But that's not it, because there's ways to grow the amount of resource slots you have other than those. I just don't know them, and I can't look up resource slots in Civipedia.
Yeah, this is another, like, that's another major thing is sort of like,
When my win condition is based on how many resources I have slotted, how do I get more? It's not warehouse buildings. I don't know what those do.
This is a complaint I have with increasing trade range. I understand why trade range is limited. You need to have some kind of limiting factor there. But, like, the ways to get extra trade range are, like, either pick a town specialty or, like, there's
I'm not sure.
Like, yeah, it's the kind of thing where I wouldn't be surprised if there are buildings that specific, you know, there's a specific caravanassery building that gives you plus trade range, but there's so few individual things. Oh, there's a suzerainty bonus, and like, I want to say that there's a wonder.
But it feels like there's also some mysterious third thing.
Yeah. Yeah, like, same with the resources, where, yeah, like, there are a couple of obvious ways, but it feels like every once in a while, you play the game, and then just randomly you're like, oh, right, that's the, you know, this is the thing that unlocks extra resource.
This does remind me, another thing we kind of got right, is we mentioned it would be cool to, since merchants in Civ 6 create roads, it'd be cool to choose where they go to choose how to make roads with them. You can do that in Civ 7, it's just you spend the merchant to create a road between two cities of yours.
Yeah.
Except it loses that ability when it matters the most in the modern era.
When it matters the most.
Yeah, it's very cool. Next one is objectives feel pretty disconnected sometimes. That, like, conceptually, for example, treasure fleets and factories are both economic concepts, but not all the treasure fleet resources are factory resources, from what I can tell.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think sugar, which is a treasure fleet resource, has a factory resource ability. Coffee is. Spices, I don't think are. Not sure about that one. It's hard to say. So it feels like even though you are doing multiple economic actions, they're not necessarily related. With culture, it's really bad because religion stops mattering in the modern era.
Yeah.
It matters a lot, and they have done some things to balance it. One of the things that I was going to have on this list already got changed and fixed, which was capital cities used to be holy cities, but you used to not be able to convert holy cities, which mattered. Now you can convert holy cities, though you never lose your religion, which I like.
Yeah.
Anyway, so, like, your religion spreading gives you relics, and explorers give you artifacts, but it feels like explorers don't have anything to do with religion or with building wonders.
Yeah.
It's just doing those paths gives you culture bonuses, which lets you start the next one sooner.
The culture victories in specific is something that Rosenkreutz brought up, is that, like, there's a strange disconnect between culture and the ways that you win culture. Like, okay, contrast this with science, for example. In science, your victory conditions are get a bunch of unique codices, get a bunch of a unique resource, and display them in buildings in, you know, your civ. Then it is get a high amount of yields utilizing specialists, then it is complete the entire tech tree and complete a bunch of projects. Like, that is, you know, boil it down to the base components, that's all it is. Culture is build 7 wonders, which, by the way, I will say the idea of building 7 fucking wonders in any Civ game before this is the kind of thing that you would focus an entire, like, playthrough doing for me.
Mm-hmm.
But build seven wonders, then get a bunch of items and display them in buildings in your sieve. Then get a bunch of items and display them in your sieve.
Yeah.
And then, I guess, build one last wonder.
Yeah.
It makes some sense from that angle, I guess. It's very palindromic, but like...
But also, again, religion doesn't do much, whereas, like, with science... As you progress through the science tree, you unlock more specialist limit.
Yeah.
And also, with science, a lot of techs will give you more adjacency bonuses, which helps you expand. But also, having a tile with a high yield naturally leads to having a higher production in science oftentimes.
Yeah.
In the modern era.
And, like, I get the idea that, like, the wonders are all unique improvements that you have to fight for, and so having seven of those is a unique thing that gives you a bunch of bonuses, but it's not the kind of thing that, like, feels cohesive. Like, you can get the Gate of All Nations and the like, and the Hanging Gardens and the Oracle, and, like, all of these individually give you good things, but, like, does it really contribute to a higher stuff? Especially especially when the base culture yield is really low on a lot of wonders.
Yeah.
Like, wonders primarily give you, like, adjacency bonuses, more or less.
The main thing is just that the monument, which is a culture building, gets adjacency from wonders.
Yeah, yeah.
I think also part of it is that wonders are unlocked via civics.
Yeah.
That's sort of the main justification for that. This does bring me into micro grievance, the next one, which wasn't originally on my list, but I thought about it this morning. I don't like the way they do great works in Great People. Great People are named, but they are civilization specific. Certain civs will allow you to create great people. And then the great works have names as well, but it doesn't feel right. I think part of why I like Civ, other than it being this board game, is that it acts like a gallery of greatest hits throughout history and cultures.
Yeah.
And I liked the aspect of, like, getting writers like Ovid and Kafka and stuff like that, and then also getting great works like the Epic of Gilgamesh or The Birth of Venus. And I feel like you don't interact with the, like, specifics of that as much. And I'm not as much of a fan of that. It is also kind of weird that great works are science for just one age, and then the next two ages their culture.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know how I feel about that. Next grievance is...
Wait, compliment sandwich? I like economic victory. I've already mentioned this. I want to just quickly say, I think economic victory is probably... Like, domination victory makes a lot of sense. Domination victory is one of the easier ones to code. I think that, like, I do think that there are, like, a lot of the individual tuned aspects are poor, let's say, could do with a lot more tuning, you know?
Yeah.
But I actually really think that the idea of, like, get a bunch, you know, import a bunch of resources, you know, very Silk Road style, literally it's the Silk Road is kind of the idea of what you're unlocking there, into exploit your colonies, into build a big factory that connects everything, that in my mind is, like, really, really cromulent.
Okay.
That all fits together very well.
Here's my thing. Traders, they help you get resources to slot, and they also can give you factory resources to put into your factories. Traders do nothing for treasure fleets.
Yeah, yeah.
Also, treasure fleets, okay, here's an issue. Map generation has been a hot topic.
Yes.
There's a lot you can say about it, but I think my biggest issue is that treasure resources are very poorly distributed, because you can have this vertical chain of islands that is about 10 hexes wide, and there will only be one treasure resource along them.
Yeah.
And so, like, obviously, you do still want to settle first in those distant lands, but there's a good chance that an AI will just be closer to those. And even then, you're only getting one treasure fleet point per turn, which is not a lot. When you consider the other win conditions of, like, the modern age, or the exploration age, the other win conditions, they give you more progress or they require less. Like, you need 15 relics to be slotted, which, let's say you take the one for converting capitals. That gives you 10, and then you can easily get the other 5 from civics.
Yeah.
That is pretty quick, all things considered, compared to like the 30 or so trade fleet points you need when each one can give you only 1 point. They spawn every 6 turns and they require 3 to 4 turns to go to your capital.
Yeah. Like you said, the map gen does feel like a big contributing factor where, like, yeah. I understand the idea that you don't want to pack the mini islands between the two main continental landmasses with resources such that somebody can only focus on those.
Yeah.
But it does lead to, like you said, I had like 3 cities on that belt and I had all 2 resources that exactly. I could exploit from it. Like,
so that's 2 points every 6 to 9 turns.
Yeah.
When
yeah.
you include travel time.
Like, yeah, it's the kind of thing where like I, of all the victory conditions, I think that economic is the one that just needs tuning more yeah. than like would need an overhaul yeah. of some kind.
Likewise with factories, I like the concept. I think the fact that it's so hard to tell why I can't build a factory in a given location.
Yeah, that one I did. The modern age, we'll get to
like,
it.
I like the idea, but it already takes a long time to unlock factories on the tech tree.
Yeah.
And then you take into account the fact that you might not be able to build factories at all. And it's like, I feel like I'm starting on the back foot when explorers you can make on turn like 4 and then get a artifact on turn 6.
Yeah, yeah.
And even then, like, you already need technology and science to unlock factories. By the time you get that started, you're literally like a third of the way through the tech tree to get to science victory.
Yeah,
it needs so many factory points as well. And then those are limited by how many slots you have for resources.
Yeah, that's limited by how many slots you have, and which it is takes confusing. A while to...
So like you have to go through all this work and all this like confusing fog for a slow win condition. Next grievance, though, is that artifacts are terrible. They've added more ways to get artifacts, but they've also made them more first come, first serve, which means you can have situations where everyone has like 10 artifacts of the 12 they need to win the culture victory, but there's no more ways to get artifacts. I don't know what to do in that case. You've essentially given me a really fast roller coaster and put the brakes on it right before it reaches the loop-de-loop. Instead, everyone else's roller coasters can do the loop-de-loop, but not you.
So, I am not in the business of, like, directly asking developers for things. If there is one thing that I feel like would do better, like, if there is one thing that I feel like should probably be long-term reevaluated, I think there should be at least 1 extra victory condition in each victory for each victory style.
Yeah.
Like, I want to be clear. I don't know what necessarily those are, but like okay, here's a good example. Tourism in Civ 5 is one of my favorite culture mechanics because like it is a non-diplomacy or non like military means of attacking your opponent, of making a problem for your opponent to then solve. Like if somebody is really really good at tourism, that might be a problem in and of itself that makes you go, well, shit, I want to build another tank, but I guess I need to build a culture building in order to shore up my defense. Like, I liked that aspect because it was the kind of thing you're fighting players for, but it's also the kind of thing where if you're not in that, it's not that you can wholly ignore it. I've wholly ignored a lot of the culture side when I haven't been specifically playing culture. I've also kind of wholly ignored, like, a lot of the science side. And
yeah.
Like, there's an amount of that that is probably built in of, like, you're specialized for military, you should be doing more military things, etc., etc. But if I do then go, I would like to play a culture civ, I have in fact done that. I have in fact gone, I'd like to play a culture civ. And you want to know what it is? It's kind of engaging in the first era, and it stops being engaging pretty quickly in the next ones, in my opinion.
So, like, I think part of the issue is that just, like, the stuff you're doing to win doesn't really affect... Okay, with wonders, you at least need to research things to get wonders, and there's, like, the wonder construction endeavor that you unlock through the tree. So, like, how you go through the tree matters. With religion, you get it when you research piety, which is one of the first ones you can unlock, and then you're kind of doing its own thing unrelated to the culture tree. In fact, religion has a separate 3-civic tree that isn't part of the tree. It's not even a tree. It's a line. And then also, with explorers, it's the same thing. Technically, you do need hegemony to research a few other things, but one of the first civics you can unlock in the modern age is explorers. And then once you do that, for the most part, explorers are doing their own thing. So it feels kind of like you are given a goal, but then the resource that you have created 1/6 of the game around is no longer relevant.
I know that religion in Civ 6 kind of had the issue of like a religious victory was the kind of thing that happened in the antiquity age, or it didn't happen at all. Mm-hmm. It was the classical era then. Like it was the kind of thing where you unlocked one civic, you unlocked another civic, and if you were spicy, you unlocked a third one. But by that point, you probably already have 100 missionaries out converting the entire world. It feels like they kind of took the fact that that was not a fully baked system and kind of went, what if we just made this the system for one age?
Yeah.
And I don't know if that works. Okay, you want to know the weirdest thing to me? The things that you can unlock with a culture and a science victory in each age, at least up until the modern era, is basically an option that says your libraries or your like monuments or amphitheaters stay how they are. Mm-hmm. Like you keep all of the yields. They don't become, you know, like very low yield things. They become Golden Age libraries, Golden Age amphitheaters, and therefore they keep their whole yield. That's cool. That's interesting. But it's weird to me that like there isn't even a secondary aspect with religion in the modern era.
Yeah.
Of like, you retain your bonuses and get an extra thing based on the religion that you just invested a bunch of time into.
Yeah. It's really awkward.
Yeah.
I think one thing with artifacts and explorers is that every other win condition has inevitability. And even with relics, to an extent, the fact that there's nothing preventing you from converting cities now means that, like, you just send more missionaries, and if they have enough charges, they can convert any city. Like, actually trying to counter-convert a city, or actually trying to defend a city is kind of difficult in that instance. Especially just because they can run out of charges and then whatever. But, like, artifacts, they don't have inevitability, but I think it's because if they did, it would happen too quickly. Like, you need 15 artifacts. If you couldn't remove dig spots from other players, then there would be too many dig spots. And if you could dig on each of them twice, once for exploration, once for antiquity artifacts, that's a lot of artifacts. Or like, I don't know. It's like the counterplay is an all or nothing zero sum counterplay when nothing else in the game is zero sum until the very end.
It's the kind of thing where like what I would do in abstract, I'll say, is draw upon like the rock bands of Civ 6, like the tourism of Civ 5, and I would turn it into, because like the core idea here is kind of like a British museum. It's you know, it's getting a bunch of artifacts from various civilizations, putting it in your capital, and then being like, we're big and important and culture and cool, and then building a big wonder to be like, come look at us, come look at how cool we are. That's a very fun idea, but it's interesting to me that like, and I guess it makes sense for specifically the modern era, but it's interesting to me that like the only form of culture that matters in this particular era is like cool antiquities.
Yeah.
Antiquities.
You're not making your blue jeans. And the fact that blue jeans have become so crucial to Civ canon since Civ 4 or 5 when it was introduced.
Yeah.
It's kind of a miss. Now, here's the thing. I alluded to this earlier. A lot of people think that we are going to get a fourth era. I think that it makes sense for expansions to add eras because the era system is already so modular and self-contained.
Yes.
A lot of people think they wanted to have four eras, but were unable to do so for time constraints. And the way that the modern era feels incomplete and anticlimactic in some regards fits that.
Yes.
Now, I think regardless of if that was intended for the primary release or if not, and it was done on emergency, doesn't really matter because they're going to make another era that's already been confirmed. I don't know if they were like, we have this great idea for how to end culture and it's, you know, cultural exports, but like they then had to remove that for time reasons.
Yeah.
It does feel weird that tourism and cultural exports, which aren't just things from previous Civ games, but also how that works in real life, don't really exist. And if anything, those are diplomatic.
Yeah.
The idea of soft power is represented through influence, but there is no diplomatic victory.
Yeah.
Now, there could be a UN. I think that would be fun. here for Axis, if you're looking for ideas, diplomatic victory, create a UN. It requires being allies with everyone. I've done it before. Or to have one person at war with everyone else. I've done that before too. Everyone was friends with me. I did world peace. Himiko defected. She hated my guts, but she promptly got embarrassed by the rest of the entire world.
Okay. This leads into, I think, my biggest criticism of the modern era. I definitely think the modern era is the one that is the least baked. And I don't want to say that.
Doughy.
I don't even want to say that without nuance too, because again, I like a lot of the ideas present, but A, how the game currently ends for a science victory, for example, science victory has always been go to the moon, go to space. You know, very fun. What that means right now is in the modern era, you unlock flight, you do the first circumnavigation of the world, you put a satellite in space, you go to space.
Yeah.
That is such a wild, like, and like, when I say you put a satellite in, you go to space, I mean, like, you unlock the second era of planes, the second thing that gives you planes, and then, like, immediately start unlocking the space stuff.
Yeah.
It's very, like, that is Cold War era. That is not. So, okay. The thing that I dislike about the modern age is ideologies. So, one of the things that I think we've alluded to before, but to explain it more in full, civs have their own individual culture trees. I like this. I love that change. I love that civs have their own small culture that you can invest in. Like, some civs are more about getting the bonuses that gives you and then using those bonuses to do other things. Some of them, it's more just like a secondary bonus if you have extra culture and extra turns that you can use. But it makes a lot of sense to be like, these are increasing benefits based on the history of your civilization. Because of this, because they are very specialized, they're usually like just 3, maybe 4. That's fine. However, ideologies, there are 3 of them, and all 3 of them have 3 levels. You get the first one, you get the second one, you get the third one. Small grievance that I'd like to add, why the fuck is fascism the one for an economic victory? Like, I understand, like, oh, it made the trains run on time. Democracy is literally the thing that led to capitalism. Like, this is a known factor, is democracy was, like, the thing that won out that then led directly to free market capitalism. However, I think that what it is more of a limitation of the fact that there's almost certainly going to be, like you said, there's going to be another era, and it's almost certainly going to be after the modern era. And so, sure, you don't want to make, like, you know, a big, big tree just for this one era, except otherwise, like, the thing about ideology is that despite the fact that it is a culture tree, it directly more impacts your military. Because choosing an ideology makes you friends with everybody with the same ideology, and everybody else hate you.
This was an optional game mode in Civ 6, the secret societies.
Yeah. And
you could also just not have an ideology, which I tend to do, because I'd rather not get in a fight.
Yes. Like, I chose fascism because I was playing Machiavelli and I was playing Mughal, and I was going for an economic victory, and I was like, oh, cool, this is the only one I can choose. All right, I guess. And everybody fucking despised me, and I was like, oh shit, I guess I have to race for this victory now before somebody decides to despise me enough that I have to fight a gigantic war. I did thankfully win, but it was a very rude, like, I understand it, I kind of like it from a narrative perspective. It is weird to me that Civ 5, for example, ideology was like the late game of culture, and when they updated it in the last expansion, they made each ideology its own buildable tree. Like, you built the foundational principles, and then when you had, you know, 2 on the bottom, you could get the second level, and then once you had enough of the second level, you could get the third level. That was cool. That was fun. That also showed that, like, there was an amount of, like, overlap, where science is very good out of communism and fascism. Culture is very good out of communism and democracy. Economics is very good out of fascism and democracy. That was fun. It is very strange to me that now all of democracy is 3 civics, and they are very specifically, oh, are you going for a science or cultural victory? Do this.
Yeah.
You know? Oh, you're going for a military or economic victory? Choose fascism.
Yeah. And again, we're not going into the actual political theory and how those are represented. It's more so like it is kind of weird to compress it down so much. And it feels like that because it's not meant to be the end of the game. I don't know. I mean, the communists have the music.
The communists do have the music.
But I don't really have much of an opinion on whether or not it is an accurate representation of those, like, philosophies or what have you. I know a lot of people commented that, like, at first it's weird that communism gives you food, but then you think about how they have, like, food is also represented via housing.
Yeah.
And you can think of, like, Soviet blocks as that, of, like, public housing.
I know that, like, hospitals and stuff are also usually represented as giving you plus food.
Yeah. So there is that. I think it's another instance where people who play Civ to be a historical sandbox and people who play it as this crunchy game mechanic-y game with strategy and builds and stuff are, like, clashing.
Yeah.
Another list on the grievances that I'm not even going to bring up because we don't have time is disasters. They either do nothing or they hurt you too much. And that's just kind of how it is it's like either it kneecaps your civilization for 10 turns or it hurts you. I understand that it helps prevent people from stalling ages, but there's a lot of times where I'm not the one responsible for stalling the age because I've already reached the end of two legacy paths. And I don't have, you know, much ability to progress the other two.
Yeah.
So I'm just sitting there like, I'm dying of disease and there's nothing I can do about it except sit here and wait. I'm not a fan of disasters. You can turn them off. I might start playing with them off in the future just because I feel like I said, it's either they do nothing or they do too much.
Yeah, I like the idea of them. I understand them from a catch-up mechanic perspective, and I think that they're very interesting from that perspective. But like you said, the game as it currently exists, you're usually at two victory conditions already, just sort of waiting for it to get done. And more often than not, like, the age completes because I have completed the science tech tree and got Future Civic a second time.
Yeah.
And it just jumped forward 5 percentage points.
Yeah.
This is another common criticism that I imagine that they're working on that this one probably won't. Like, this one is probably one that will be changed sooner rather than later, I imagine.
Mm-hmm.
But how it's going to be tuned is probably going to be one of the big. It's something, again, it's an idea that I like, but as it's currently tuned, it just feels like it is made for a different game.
I will say, here's a good thing the game did, I guess. The fact that you can play as Mississippi means that you can have Cahokia as a city. Let's go. St. Louis mentioned. Specifically Cahokia mentioned. Really cool place. I've been there.
Cahokia is there, and if you play as the Mississippi, you can also get a city that is Missouri, which is, you know, fine or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, I think, I don't remember if that was something we talked about or mentioned in the Civ 6 episode, but thanks.
Yeah, thanks, I guess.
I just think it's cool. I like Cahokia.
I unironically, I love the Mississippi because I love economic expansion. Economic expansion is my favorite type of Civ. And like, I love that every time I play them, I get to slap down Cahokia and be like, I recognize that place. I've been to those mounds.
Mm-hmm. My favorite leaders to play are Ibn Battuta, who is very flexible, but has a really funny strategy where you power out your first settler before everyone else.
Yeah.
I've been trying to get Trung Trak to work. Very difficult. I like Ben Franklin, and I've liked Ada Lovelace so far, because she can yume through the tech tree. I will say as well, I agree with people that Maya is busted. Otherwise, I don't have many opinions on the Civs themselves, especially as they go through the ages.
As it currently stands, I could not feel confident enough in a lot of those opinions, basically.
Mm-hmm.
I do like Machiavelli, and I like interacting with the...
Bro said he likes Machiavelli.
Yeah.
That's the worst thing you've said on this podcast.
It's true. Call me the prince, because I'm trying to... I don't even know where I'm going with this. I like Machiavelli. I like Harriet Tubman. I probably need to play Greece, considering that their Civ bonus is just getting more... like, literally just getting more influence.
The funniest thing is that Harriet Tubman starts with, like, +3 free war support. Meaning nobody wants to declare war on Harriet Tubman.
It's so good.
That's funny.
Like, yeah. That's, like, honestly, that might be the thing that gets me to continually play her. Just because, like, the espionage is fine. the way I play, I end up being friends with everybody, and so I don't really want to use espionage.
Yeah.
But it is a good, like, it's a very good bonus, especially, I imagine, in multiplayer. And yeah, the fact that, like, the fact that you get an immediate bonus to war weariness is very nice and does do an amount of, like, dissuading people from attacking you.
Yeah. And then you add that with the military attribute that gives you free war weariness. You add that with Gate of All Nations. And just people declare war on you and they are immediately depressed. Yeah. It's, again, it's like, it has neat stuff. I think the mementos are cool and add some fun strategizing. It's confusing to me sometimes because the button to change them between ages is hidden away.
Yeah.
And the button to change them and select them on multiplayer lobbies is hidden away.
Yeah.
But that... they're necessary and they're very important.
Okay. Here is a niche criticism. This is one of the criticisms that I'm going to say. I don't think they should change the game. This is entirely a me thing. I kind of hate mementos because it means that every leader has a battle pass, and how to unlock that battle pass is play multiple games of Civ. Yeah.
So you can always end after one era, but even then you still have to play one era.
Yeah.
And like, I do wish either the mementos were quicker to unlock than they are. Like, you could unlock all of them in two games, I think would be fine. Especially because you have to play leaders you don't care about in order to get all of them.
Yeah.
And while normally they do give abilities that are based off of what they are,
yeah,
like the military leaders will give military mementos, it's still good to have those for other things, especially if you like one military leader and not the other.
Yeah, it's a fun system because a lot of times you unlock a small sub-ability that is related to the leader, and that's fun. Like, literally, Harriet Tubman's first unlock is she gets a migrant every time you complete an espionage action. Very fun theming. I like that a lot. Oh yeah,
migrants were also something we mentioned in the episode.
Oh my god, yeah, that's right.
It works differently than what we said, but...
Hey, Sid Meier, I know that we were joking. If you are listening to us, actually do reach out. Or maybe another developer, I don't know. Like, I...
Sid Meier is the Todd Howard of Civilization.
Yeah, if something goes wrong and I immediately curse Sid Meier's name.
Yeah.
So, yeah, the mementos, like, I don't think they should change anything. What I would add is, like, Civ 6, Civ 5, they had, like, side campaigns. They had scenarios, you know? Where it's, like, you picked... It was the fall of Rome or, like, you know, the colonization of Africa. Those were fun because they were side things that you could, you know, use a lot of game knowledge for, but in a different, unique scenario. What I would do personally is have some of those and have those contribute to the XP.
Here's what you do. You have one for each leader that brings in, like, their strategies.
They're, like, special, yeah.
Yeah, they're special things. Like, I feel like that makes sense. That's something everything does. Fucking Yu-Gi-Oh! Does that. Bloons does that.
You brought up Yu-Gi-Oh! I referenced that I want to rant. I'm going to keep this very short.
Okay, because we're probably
wrapping this up after this one. We've been recording for a while. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much for your service, for everything that you do.
You're welcome.
So, there is a social policy called Medic. The text on the Medic card is +5 HP... for, like, +5 HP heal to units. That is all the card says.
Mm-hmm.
This single card is my absolute least favorite thing in the entire game. Because it says +5 heal to units. Does that mean if I take the heal action with units, then they will get an extra +5 healed, which I believe that they heal 15 by default, so +33% heal? Or does that mean every turn they will heal +5, which is equivalent to 1/3 of a heal action every turn? Or does that mean when I slot it in, they heal +5 and then nothing else happens, I guess?
So,
like,
I have it on good authority, which is that there are other effects that are +5 heal to units, that it is the former of those three. It is when you take the heal action, you heal more health.
That is fair. That is fair.
It doesn't say that, and yeah, it should is vague.
It should say, like, per turn, or when you take the heal action.
Yeah, like healing is +5 stronger or something.
This is, like, the thing that annoyed the shit out of me is just that this is like Magic the Gathering from 1990s rules. You know, this is design cues we have had in, like, if reading the card does not explain the card, you have made a bad card. And I hate to say it, I hate to be that directly rude about it, but it just kind of is true. And that one card is something that I have, like, ranted to multiple friends about.
Yeah, because what do you mean? There's a river between the battlefield. Which side of the river is it on?
Yeah. God. I can't believe that legacy text made it a difficult card. It made more sense in the original text than the legacy text.
We all love old shitty Magic cards, like the Shell Game hat one, or I think there's a different one. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
We love the one that makes you take a card and rip it up. And then we love the one that is an unset card that makes you take it and rip it up.
The rip it up is the unset card.
No, there was a different card that you could tap and then rip it up and then spread it all over your guys and you would win.
I know this because
I know Magic the Gathering history.
Literally incorrect. I know our history, which is that, judging by the length of this episode, who knows if this will all be in one piece when we're done. So I think we need to call it here. Thank you for listening. You can find us on any podcasting platform you like. Give us a like, give us a rating, give us a review. Let us know how we're doing. Let us know what you want to hear us cover next or things you think we might like. You can also find us on Twitter at NetSurferPro and on Blue Sky at netsurferpro.bsky.social. And we post teasers for upcoming episodes on there, as well as updates on delayed episodes. So it's like an early peek and a late peek. That's fun. You can find me online at twack or twackaroo or at twack.bsky.social, T-W-A-K or T-W-A-K-A-R-O-O. I mainly post on Blue Sky nowadays. I post my hot takes, a lot of pinball posting, whatever comes to mind. And then also, you can find me on Twitch, on twitch.tv/twack, T-W-A-K, yet again, where I stream. I've been streaming a lot of Civ 7. You can see me do wacky builds, like the Ibn Battuta one I mentioned. I've got an idea for Trung Track that I want to try on stream, but that'll happen later. I've also been streaming through UFO 50 as well, and a lot of other shit. So, yeah, follow me on there, I guess. Yeah. I don't know. I'm not your parental figure.
However, I am your parental figure, so I'm going to tell you to both clean your room and also to follow me on TikTok and on Blue Sky at Galen Wilson. That's at GALANWILS0N. That's .bsky.social for Blue Sky. I post my hot takes and, you know, opinions about video games, what have you. You can find me on YouTube at The Only Galen on YouTube, and you can find me on Twitch at twitch.tv/machinegunvampire. Maybe follow Twack first, but, you know, I have been doing a couple more streams here and there. Honestly, we might do, like, a multiplayer stream at some point. I imagine that's the kind of thing that we might just both have a free day that you're streaming, and I'll just be like, hey, wanna play Civ 7?
I'll have to turn on the turn timer, though. You know what? You know, I do feel like it is fitting that we have taken this long for a Civ episode, given how long our multiplayer games take.
Oh!